Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first 42 minutes of 2012. Today, William Morgan, my usual co-conspirator, is off on sync assignment, and he'll be away for a couple weeks, actually, and I'm sure he's going to have some good stuff when he comes back. But today I'm joined by Alan. I after all the mispronunciation of everyone's names, is it Abadesa or Abadesa?
I say Abadesa. I don't know.
Abadesa. Alan Abadesa Green. Do you think you're ever going to lose that and just go straight green?
Oh, that's a long answer. I don't know. Come on, it's 2012. It's just...
Lately, I've been, because you pop up every now and again on 42 Minutes, I think of you as Alan Greenman, you know, like Alan Green Room, you know, so the green is... And then, I don't know if you folks realize that Alan just had his birthday. Happy birthday, Alan. And that was
thank you.
New Year's Eve.
I was born New Year's Eve, yeah. So my birthday was just a few days ago. And actually, we spent my birthday. So on December 30th, we went to see a movie. There's a movie theater in Manhattan that does like classic retrospectives. And we went to see a Miyazaki film on the 30th. So that was like the night of the 30th. So when we left the theater, it was my birthday. And then, like, it was just before midnight. And then we had my birthday. And then at midnight, New Year's Eve, we went back to that theater. And there was a film starting at midnight, Jodorowsky's Holy Mountain. So the first minute of 2012, I'm in the theater as Holy Mountain is beginning. So I started 2012 with Holy Mountain. I thought it was very appropriate.
Yeah, that's great. the intentions, we don't have any guests. It's just Alan and I, and we're going to talk about 2011 and 2012. So, you know, we're just going to look back. We'll do a kind of a retrospective show, thinking about where we've come in a year and then where we're going, where we hope to go. And, you know, we'll hunt out some black swans maybe. I don't know. Should we just start right into it?
I think you already started the call, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, we started into it. Wait, how do we eat this beast?
Say again, how do we what?
How do we eat this beast?
You know, start at the beginning, then come to the end and stop.
Okay. Well, in Finnegan's Wake, apparently every part is both beginning, middle, and end, and that's what's so fabulous about it. But
I think that you're right. That's a huge part of sync, right? Is the idea that you know everything is whole within itself. Every piece of the puzzle contains the whole, and that's certainly been a lesson we've learned again and again throughout the last year or few.
Yeah. Here's something interesting I noticed this year. I kept seeing the little text or phrase, party like it's 2012, which seems so odd because, you know, they're obviously referencing Prince's party like it's 1999. You know, so at that moment in time, it was always, I think he wrote that in the 80s, so they're looking ahead to this time when something's going to happen. And I thought it was just so trite to say party like it's 2012 because, you know, but then I started really thinking about it and I appreciate that because it's like, oh, we've finally arrived. Everything's now. You know, we're going to party like it's now.
Yeah, for all my reservations about 2012 as being it. You know, I do have a lot of reservations about that, but I do like that it seems like the cusp got closer. You know, usually, especially like with science fiction, you know, 1984 was written this time. You know, it's like always projecting future, right. future. It's like, well, it's got to be far enough away that it's realistic. And now, instead of, you know, Lucy moving the football away from Charlie Brown, the football is getting closer, you know, and it's like we're actually approaching it. And I like that we would be on the cusp of something and that you'd only have to project it forward a few months instead of 50 years. So there is something appealing about that.
What, and that could lead right into a topic. The idea of the think rapture. You know, so we're moving towards something. And this is something within the community of think that causes problems because it speaks to, like, the purpose of the endeavor. You know, so how one views it's, you know, it's the story. One story is going to communicate the purpose of the sync. And so it seems to all move towards that Terrence McKenna zero point or Ray Kurzweil's singularity. But I'm a literature guy, and I don't necessarily need the sync rapture to be literal. And so this is a fascinating subject to me, how people think of the end. How do you think of the end?
Sure. Well, I mean, just think of it basically the same thing we were just saying of, like, bringing it closer. You know, it's always going to be, well, in the future, we'll have ascended into the fourth or fifth dimension, or in the future, we'll all be in a kingdom of heaven, or in the future, you know, we're going to be a technological singularity, or, you know, everyone's trying to envision what this future point is. I think if there's any lessons to be learned from moving that field goal closer, the idea of living in the now is that this, if there's going to be a miraculous realization, it's that we're going to have to make heaven on earth. So to me, what I sort of see, if there is a metaphorical end, it's like waking up to the fact that this is what we have to make special. These everyday conversations, these everyday relationships, everyday interactions, everyday tiny little miracles, all these things are what we're going to have to realize. And it's suddenly like, you know, like you said, that the future is now, well, heaven is now, or the rapture is now. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we become star seeds or light beings or whatever, you know, a lot of these terms like to get tossed around. It means that we realize that, you know, we make of this life what we make of it. I know it's not the most popular answer, but it's the answer that works for me. And, you know, I told you I started 2012 off with Holy Mountain, and it's sort of like, you know, you go up the mountain and you become enlightened, you know, quote-unquote enlightened, and then you come back down, and it's like, there's work to do. All right, you got to come off the mountain and, you know, what is it, right? Go, you know, before enlightenment, you chop wood, gather water. After enlightenment, gather wood, chop water. Chop water, exactly. You got me.
Kevin, early on in the show's history, said something that it still sticks with me, you know, and he's such a great individual, but he said, you know, the purpose is to replant the gnosis. You know, so it's coming back, you know, it's the 12th step of AA, or, you know, you go up and get it yourself so that you can give it to somebody else. And I really liked that.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful. And to me, I mean, you know, I'm more than open to 2012 being something both literal and, you know, metaphorical. But I think ultimately, you know, my answer is if we don't realize the lesson of making something out of this, all that's going to happen is 2012 is going to pass, and we're just going to set that field goal back another 50 years. You know, I think there's a lot of people who are going to, 2012 is going to pass, and they're going to be very disappointed. Well, aliens didn't land on the White House lawn, or, you know, we didn't birth into some white race. I think they're going to be very disappointed if something like that doesn't happen. And ultimately, it's like the people who are going to get it are going to be people who go, no, wait, you know, I have to make something of this. There's no escape plan. There's no get out of jail free card. You know, Buddha's not going to drop out of the sky and just give everyone the gift of enlightenment. It's they got to figure it out for themselves, I think.
Well, I think that, and this just came to me, that 2012 is like a stage, and now you have the opportunity to do whatever you'd like on the stage.
Yeah.
You know, the moment's arrived. Show us what you want. Here's something. Speaking to what you were just saying, I'm into a book right now, but you have to see it to believe. But then think of it the reverse of that too. You have to believe it to see it. And so I'm thinking about Harold Campion, or Camping, and where part of this shift, or you know, whatever, is it's more, there's this participatory element in it that 2012 could be nothing or it could be something. It all depends on you. So it's time to party like it's 2012, I suppose.
Sure, and I will give you a hypocritical little thing here, or a contrary thing, is that there, what I realized was, if you remember going back, everyone made a big deal out of Y2K, right? Everyone was saying, and it was all those new millennium celebrations, which for anyone who can do simple math, year 2000 was not the millennium anyway. Even if we're going to go by the Gregorian calendar, you don't start at year zero, you start at year one. There is no year zero. So the millennium would have to be 2001 anyway. And I made that argument all throughout 1999 and 2000, and no one cared. But the point is, in 99, everyone was excited about the quote-unquote new millennium of 2000 and Y2K. But the real year that everyone remembers is 2001. 2001 was our Stargate year, if you will.
Right.
Well, what I realized is that the year 2011 that we just passed is also a Y2K, right? 11 being a K being the 11th letter of the alphabet. So the year 2011 is 211 or 2K.
Right.
So we just got out of Y2K. Perhaps this is the year after Y2K, where the real, you know, the real action takes place.
Yeah. Another fascinating element about 2011 has been the emergence of the number 10 for me in that. So it's the 10th anniversary of 2001. You know, so now we're talking about 2Ks. There's 2001, Y2K, as you just said, and then 2011, you know, and so you have these bookends, these moments that might be the same moment, but, you know, a different view, you know, looking back with the 10. And I the 10 is something that I'm still investigating.
Well, so, you know, we could answer the 10 being, so 10 is thought of as perfection, right? You know, 10 is,
yes.
You know, 10 is the divine number in many systems. So, have we come full circle?
So thinking about 10 as the purity of your heart when you're 10, you know, and then what we've become since we've been 10 is mostly egoic survival equipment, and that. So we'll get into 2011 a little bit. The same themes that I have been looking at this past year are kind of getting back, you know, to the idea of 10, you know, magical thinking, seeing the world with wonder and not as, you know, survival in the machine that we created.
Yeah, and it's that childish wonder I think is so important. You know, there's a Dr. Seuss book. It's for younger readers. It's called 10 Apples Up on Top. And to me, the secret of the universe is contained within this story. And it's basically three animals. I think it's a tiger, a bear, and, oh God, I don't know. I think it might be a lion. Maybe it's a lion, a tiger, and a bear. I don't know. We'd have to look it up. But three animals, and they have this contest. How many apples can you stack on top of your head? And so it's like, oh, I could do two apples. Oh, yeah, I could put three apples stacked on top of my head. And the story goes like that, and it's, you know, just cute and silly. And then it starts getting more and more absurd. And then they end up where they all do 10, and 10 seems to be, like, the max number that they can do. But once they hit 10, they start, they're just so ecstatic that they reach 10, right? It's this ecstasy point. And then suddenly they get chased by these angry mobs who are like, stop with those apples up on your head. And everyone's infuriated that they're walking around with 10 apples on their head. So they're just the crazy, lone, you know, people who are living in the beauty and the wonder of the moment. And everyone else around them gets so furious. And they get chased by this angry mob who demands they take the apples off. What ends up happening is they chase them and they crash into like an apple cart. And suddenly everyone has 10 apples up on top. Everyone has 10 apples on top of their head. And everyone goes, oh, this is so awesome. Now I get it. And suddenly everyone's doing it and everyone's ecstatic. And it's this really beautiful, you know, maybe that's the sick rapture. Right now we're the crazy ones and maybe, you know, after the crash, suddenly everyone has 10 apples up on top. I'd dig that.
That's funny. But you, after the crash, there's this hint of darkness. Last week, Will and I mean, it seemed like our talk got pretty dark, that we're thinking about what 1984 is saying. Is there a dark moment on the horizon? You know, if we're black swan hunting, you know, in the vein of Goro Adachi, I've been seeing the re-release of Titanic, you know, 100 years. Is the boat going down again? Are we stuck in the
where they're relaunching the same? Now this is interesting. I had made the argument I'm not really making an argument for it, but I'm showing the correlation between the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey and the movie Contact. And in the movie Contact, there is very obvious correlations to 2001: A Space Odyssey. It's like harped on again and again. It's like, hey, basically we're ripping off 2001. But they build the Stargate machine, and the first Stargate is destroyed. It's blown up by a religious fundamentalist who blows it up in a suicide terrorist attack. And they have to build a second Stargate. And what I realized was, well, if our 2001 Stargate, you know, the Jake Coetzee 2001 Stargate was destroyed in this explosion, regardless of it actually was a fundamental terrorist suicide bombing or if it was Illuminati or New World Order or whomever, it doesn't matter. Just to say symbolically, our first Stargate was destroyed. Do we get a second chance? And it's something that it's given me a small amount of hope there. And the idea of this relaunching of the Titanic, where they're basically repeating the Titanic voyage in 2012, maybe we get a chance to not go down. Maybe we get a chance to not be destroyed. In Contact, she makes it through on the second trip. Maybe the Titanic will as well. Maybe we make it through as well.
The pirate asks Spartacus, frankly, whether he is aware that the slave rebellion is doomed, that sooner or later the rebels will be crushed by the Roman army. Would he continue to fight to the end, even in the face of inevitable defeat? Spartacus's answer is, of course, affirmative. The slave struggle is not merely a pragmatic attempt to ameliorate their position. It is a principled rebellion on behalf of freedom. So even if they lose and are killed, their fight will not have been in vain, since they will have asserted their unconditional commitment to freedom. In other words, their act of rebellion itself, whatever the outcome, already counts as a success insofar as it instantiates the immortal idea of freedom. And one should give to idea here its full Platonic weight. This is from a book that I got for Christmas. It's called Living in the End Times by Slavoj Zizek. I also got, and these are gifts from my father, a book called How to Build a Time Machine and a new tarot deck called the Wildwood Tarot. And what's interesting, or what this speaks to me, is the OWS movement. You know, if we're talking about 2011, did that movement have any meaning? Did they accomplish anything? And this little quote kind of says, everything you do is important. You know, even if what you're doing isn't for you, it's also for everyone else. And the paragraph goes on to say, our struggle is not against actual corrupt individuals, but against those in power in general, against their authority, against the global order and the ideological mystification which sustains it. You know, so part of my idea of the Sync Rapture is creating the world that we want to live in. And to do that, you have to see the world that you want to live in and then lead people to it, which might sound crazy.
No, it doesn't sound crazy. You know, it's funny when you said OWS, because while you were reading that, I was, of course, thinking of Occupy Wall Street, right? The idea of, you know, this, or this V for Vendetta. Even before that, there was the V mask. And it's the idea of ideas are bulletproof. You can kill me, but you can't kill an idea. It's this idea of, you know, the struggle continues. But when you said OWS, what I thought you were saying was something like O.W. Grant. We did the whole thing with Interstate 60, and I thought you were saying O.W. Grant, which, of course, in that movie, it was One Wish Granted. So what is OWS? One Wish, what's the S? but... Not to take it off on a tangent, but I just
it's interesting. So, One Wish Sync.
You know, but in Interstate 60, I mean, basically, what did he have to realize is that he had to find his own answers. He discards the life his father had planned for him to forge his own future. I think it ties in pretty well with what you're saying. If there is any symbolic meaning to the OWS right now, the Occupy Wall Street, it's the idea of, you know, we're not going to do it the old way anymore, throwing off the sort of old chains, throwing off the old law, the old rules, and forging ahead. And, you know, I think warts and all, you know, I don't think a lot of the people... Well, you know, it's not just dependent on Occupy Wall Street. I don't think a lot of people have great answers. They still have to figure a lot of stuff out, myself included. I don't mean that as like a judgmental, oh, look at those guys. They don't have it figured out. I'm saying we're still in the process of learning. But I think part of that learning process is you got to, you know, rise or fall on your own merits, and we've got to try this. I think our generation, or our 2012, you know, the people on this planet at this time, we have to figure out, are we going to do it the old way, or can we try something new? And, you know, it'll be a process for us to figure out what we can accomplish with our ideas and our ideals.
Right. I mean, so does consumer capitalism work? Do we want that to continue? Or is there something?
Right.
And, I mean, do we have to have it completely spelled out? I mean, so one of the things that I've heard is that, you know, it's a phoenix. And maybe this is the magic of Occupy Wall Street, is that you burn you burn the old system, and that's the 1984 darkness, maybe, that everything burns around you so that the new thing can rise up from the ashes.
Yeah, and I think we have to be cautious about, of course, what rises up out of the ashes. You know, the conspiracy theorists would say this is, you know, the whole order out of chaos. This is a planned collapse so that some pure new world order can rise out of it. And I think there might be something to that. But whether or not it's literally planned or not, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, of course, the danger is always there. We have the danger of, you know, you and I talked last week with Stefan about the idea that, you know, just because you blow up the Death Star doesn't, you know, and you kill the Emperor doesn't mean that you've abolished evil in the world. It doesn't mean you've completely succeeded. And the danger is always there to become the Empire yourself. The temptation to give in to the darkness is always there. So I think, you know, I come back to this idea that in the 60s, you know, there was this idea of the Age of Aquarius. So we're all going to make it through this, you know, Stargate or water door. Well, that culminated perhaps in Watergate, the Watergate event, but it wasn't that everyone suddenly became ascended. It was, all right, they got rid of one douchebag dictator Nixon, but they ended up instead with a whole new set of, you know, crony capitalists and theocratic dictators, just like the ones that came before. They didn't really make it, and a lot of the hippies became yuppies, and they became the very same consumer capitalists that they rallied against. So the danger is always there of becoming your enemy, of becoming your own slave master. I think the lesson is to remember that and do your damnedest to, you know, if your ideas are bulletproof and our ideas really are worth treasuring, it's the idea to keep them as valid as possible, as long as possible, and to keep them in your heart so that you don't become the very thing you despise.
Maybe that's the nature of the beast, that you need the law for guidance, but then eventually the law is what aids you. You know, Justin was talking about this, that the thing, the point of his, whatever he said, I forget, but, he, you know, it's the thing that freed you eventually will enslave you, kind of.
Yeah, he did say that.
You know, this, I think of it in terms of, like, the Old Testament, where they eventually, and I don't, my interpretation is probably wrong, but that they needed Jesus to free them from their service of the law, you know, the Torah, that total, they'd become, and that's definitely a Western Christian point of view, that point of view, and it's not necessarily mine, but
doesn't that seem to copy over into, like, you know, the communist idea was that, oh, they were going, you know, you needed to have this, what's essentially, a communist state in place, but it was just during the transition, and then the state would fall away, and we could all just understand how to live in this communist paradise. And even I hear, presently I hear, you know, like, libertarians and quote-unquote anarchists who say, well, all right, you know, we can try and transition out of government and we can transition towards self-sovereignty, but right now we need to follow the Constitution, and then eventually that too could fall away and we'd learn how to be self-sufficient people. And it's like, that sounds exactly like what the communists said. It's like, it's the same idea of the, you know, that 50-year future progression, that 50-year field goal pushing it down the line. Oh, we can be free in the future. You know, okay. Right now we need a communist state or we need a libertarian republic, but in the future that'll all go away and we'll figure it out. You know, I'm waiting for, it's like, no, right now, let's figure it out. let the decaying, rotting flesh fall off, and, you know, that's when the phoenix can rise.
Right. That talk reminds me, and the documentary we watched, all watched over by Machines of Love and Grace.
What happened? Oh, okay. Doug just disappeared for a minute there, and I'm gonna claim.
What happened? Did that terminate the call?
Doug just disappeared for a minute there. It shows the call is still being recorded. So, do you have a way of calling back in, and I can just keep this going? All right. So I'm going to just sort of run with that idea for a minute, and we'll see what can happen here. We were talking about the Phoenix Rising. So Doug had made the point of whether or not this was a Western idea, whether or not this was an Eastern idea, or rather, you know, was this something that was almost universal? And so there is the idea of trying to figure out what we can do, how long we have to sort of live with the old law. And again, I mean, I take this back to the Interstate 60 moment of he's trying to get rid of the father's old law, and then he's again confronted with all these different instances where he has to face, there's a town of Moore law, and there was another town in there with Kurt Russell who wants to impose his law. And even the eight ball, which he trusts that he got from O.W. Grant, he trusted the answers that's giving him, and ultimately he has to take that eight ball and throw it away and say, like, I'm not going to live by answers that are provided for me anymore. He had to sort of forge his own destiny. And that was the point at which, you know, the movie has its quote-unquote happy ending. You know, that was what he needed to do, and I would argue that's what all of us need to do. And that would actually, you know, I mean, this is the criticism of the OWS movement, is that the people, for some of them, you know, sort of petitioning the government to rein in corporations, is that our temptation again with the old law? Are we, you know, making a deal with one devil to fight the other? And, you know, of course, the quote-unquote political right is trying to get the corporations to save them from big government. I think these are sort of both sides are being tempted by what's essentially the same exact thing. And anyone paying attention would argue it's actually the same control system anyway, in a literal sense. But metaphorically, it's, of course, we're all sort of struggling, whatever your political leanings, they're struggling with that same beast of the old law and trying to figure out how to forge it for themselves.
I'm back.
I saw.
I don't know. When I came back, I got the little tune, song and dance that TalkShoe does, and so I don't know. This is a strange recording, maybe, possibly.
It shows me that this call is being recorded, so I think you're okay.
I think so. I shouldn't speak out against, but machines have watched, you know, these machines are not watching over me. The idea that I was getting at is we're talking about liberty and freedom, and we want stability, but all these concepts are flowing things. All life. I think I made that statement that the nature of nature is flow, or, you know, change. Change is the natural state of nature, and what we as human creatures desire is stability, you know, in government, in all things, but what we end up doing is creating an infrastructure that inhibits us. And so I think freedom requires us to take apart the structures that we use to create stability.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's something to be said for anything like the machine stability is trying to, at its very best, replicate or control nature. And if there is to be a system that actually is stable, it is the most natural system in place. It's the system on which the universe operates. And there does seem to be a sort of operating system at the heart of the universe. And I think Sync, if it teaches us anything, it sort of points us towards that. You know, it does seem to remind us again and again that there is an order there. And, you know, everyone makes the argument, you know, it's order out of chaos, order out of chaos. I think the chaos is the order. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, everything comes to the perspective, you know, something can be perceived as chaos, but by observing that chaos over a period of time, you might find a pattern, you know, and so that doesn't mean that the chaos, you've tamed it, but that it has some kind of meaning to you, or that you can sense
you have a relationship within.
Well, you actually have a relationship to it because you're not, and that speaks to something. The idea of property and control. You know, chaos is scary because we can't control it. We don't own it. But, you know, by just observing something with an openness, you know, you bond with it, and then you have a relationship to it. So, I don't know. Maybe that's what's emerging from the flames, is that capitalism, out of necessity, you own and control things, and this is where we find our stability, but that Sync is showing that that you can't own or control anything. This is folly. That what you need is just to be in the flow and open to what's happening. We're moving towards the end of this conversation. Sorry, Alan, but you should make whatever point you were going to make.
No. I liked everything you were saying, and you know, ultimately, 2011 I think taught us a lot of things. We made a lot of progress as far as sort of figuring out and at least appreciating the different points of view, the different. I think if anything, 2011 really, for me, what I saw was a sort of coming to peace with a lot of the different perspectives in the community, in the wider community, and within our smaller Sync community, sort of coming to terms with where the disagreements lie, and figuring out that this is a part of the individuation process, things like that. But we've also, while in the process of respecting each other's individual perspectives, we've strengthened our sort of collective force that allows us to move forward and allows us to be a sort of unified front with all its individual facets and faces. And maybe that's how we should weave things, is with the note of that, where we go from here as a unified front. Do you want to bring up some of that?
Yeah. Collective force. You're talking about the community as a whole. What does 2012 have in store for us? I mean, first thing we have to say is on the 31st of January, there's the coolest Sync event that I've ever seen happening in New York City.
Well, hopefully it's going to be as cool as all that. Yeah, it sure seems like it's coming together that way.
How big is this? Is the room? So how many tickets do you have to sell, or how soon will this thing sell out? Is what I'm saying. You know, how fast do people need to grab these tickets up?
Yeah, I mean, the space is only 44 seats, and the 44 is, of course, a magic number. I know, particularly for Michael and a few others, but it's a 44 seat space. tickets. If you want to go, get onto thesyncbook.com, get the tickets, because I can't guarantee how much, you know, the event is in less than a month now. We just announced it. We've already sold a bunch of tickets. I would advise people to get on it. It's, of course,
okay.
Just to quickly say, it's in New York. There's going to be 8 of the Sync Book authors. If I can think off the top of my head, it's me, it's Kevin Halcott, it's Peg Carter, I'm just looking at my book cover here, it's Kyle Hunt, it's Andras Jones, it's
Jennifer Palmer, Christopher Hunter Myers.
Yes, thank you.
Grammar.
It's too early in the morning for me to remember everything. Yeah, it's Jennifer Palmer and Christopher Myers, absolutely. It's going to be 8 of us there. Everyone's going to do some presentations. We're going to have a Radio 8 Bowl event there. We're going to have a bunch of some interesting live performance stuff happening. Oh, I left out Rammer Martinez. Rammer Martinez is also going to be there. How could I forget Rammer? It's going to be pretty damn interesting. And what we hope to do there is also celebrate a kickstarting of a new venture, which is Sync Book Press, which maybe you can speak a little to.
Okay, so I have a minute, but
give us a few minutes. Explain.
All right. Sync Book Press, the idea is that there's momentum as a community from the initial Sync Book, the project, and that there are more books out there that want to be written, but that we can utilize the momentum we have as a community to put these books out collectively. So if you've got a book that you want to put out, the Sync Book Press might be the place to, you know, you've got visibility, and then we all speak the same language, and so I think it's a great idea. I know that I have a book that's coming out in early April. Andras Jones has a book that's in the can, and I'm ready to see this thing. There's, some tweaking they need to do, but it's going to be coming out shortly, too. And so...
Yeah, that should be coming out by, I believe, the spring equinox is the planned release date for that.
That's 42 minutes. We're at 42 minutes.
Okay.
What are we doing?
Was there anything else? I was trying to look at my email and see what else were we supposed to announce. So we got Sync Book Press. You got your book, Andras's book. We got the January event. I feel like there was something else. Oh, just
April
quickly to
event.
Say...
What?
Yeah, please. Please. I have you say that, and I got one more, too.
We're out of time. In Boise, there's going to be a reading for my book when it comes out.
And the last thing to say is that I know there is going to be a complete redesign of the syncbook.com. Expect a beautiful new redesign coming from Justin Morgan very shortly. I've seen what's there so far, and it is beautiful. Expect a new website as well.
Okay, lots of hope for 2012. That's all we got to say.
See you guys next week.